Hey, Kyle.
Kyle.
Hi.
Thank you
Hi,
so
Kyle.
much. Oh my
Thanks for
God.
coming.
Okay. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate you showing up for this Zoom. This is super weird, but I'm not going to talk about it being weird because that's just weird. So my name is Kyle Walker, and I'm a grateful recovering methaholic, and my sober date is May 12th, 2015. And what I mean by methaholic is I drink alcohol, and the second it crosses my mouth today, I then need meth. So that is why I consider myself a methaholic. So I want to start, what I love about this meeting is that because it's a recovery meeting, what I love is I get to pull in the tools that I use from different fellowships and different A's. And one of the things that I like to start with is page 83 of the NA book states that a symptom of our disease is alienation, and honest sharing will free us to recover. And the reason I say that is because that was very true for me in my addiction. I was very much a people didn't I was a social drinker for sure. But what people didn't see is what happened after I got home from, happy hour. Like normal people, I feel like, they would like leave a sip, of like the margarita, and I'd be like, "What is your problem? Like, what are you doing?" But what would happen afterwards is where it became very apparent to me that I had a problem with alcohol, because I would black out. I mean, bottom line, this was before Uber. Like, this was before I was living in Katy and, working in downtown Houston. And that's a drive, that's quite a drive. And I would forget getting home, with my kid in the car. So, I'm not proud of that fact, but I do say a lot of things. My journey in motherhood is a very big part of my story because before I entered recovery, I was pretty disinterested in being a good mom. And that's just my truth. And I have to say that one of the best side effects of this new way of life is that I have a desire to be a good mom. And I get to be that mom that I always wanted and the mom I always needed. So I was born in Alabama. My dad was military. My mom worked at Fort Rucker, so I was born in Fort Rucker, Alabama. And my dad and my mom both smoked weed, and obviously my name's Kyle Omeo Walker. But we quickly moved to Texas when I was 5 years old, because he joined the Air Force. And Bergstrom is here. And so anyhow, we were kind of a military transplant. And the reason I say that is because I feel like being a military kid is kind of its own like ism to a certain degree, because the degree of self-sufficiency and self-reliance that was expected from me as a very young girl, kind of, while it was great at the time, when I developed into an addict later in life, it made my first step experience near impossible, to surrender, right? Because that's not something you do in the military unless you absolutely have to. So I remember my dad putting me on a bus when I was about 8 years old in Austin. And granted, this is 83, right? So it's a totally different Austin. But he put me on a bus somewhere near the Capitol, and gave me some quarters and told me to find my way home, and that's just the kind of dad he was. I knew how to, shine shoes. He would always ask me which way we were going, north, south, east, west. Like, I knew algebra. I knew everything way before I needed to know it, because my dad wanted me to be a self-sufficient little unit, little person, and so my parents got divorced, which was really fine. They weren't really well suited for each other, so that wasn't necessarily traumatic for me. But What happened when they divorced was that my dad took a very white collar journey. He used his GI Bill to get a degree in engineering, and he, you know, cleaned his act up. He went, you know, started working for the city of Austin. And my mom, on the other hand, did not. So she really stayed in kind of the hippie, she keeps Austin weird. Let's just say that. So I grew up, you know, 80% of my time with my mom. And my mom never chilled out. You know, she was very much a party girl. She worked for the IRS for years and years. And then she developed a cocaine habit, a cocaine problem. And, you know, I want to say quit her civil service job, like 3 years shy of being able to have a pension or whatever. Like it totally did not make sense, but my mom wasn't well. And, so throughout all of this, what I learned was, I learned a lot of things from my mom. You know, I learned how to, pass as far as like, you know, people in your neighborhood not knowing that you grow weed and you sell weed, and that weed is a very integral part of the household. So that was my truth. Like that was what I grew up in. And it wasn't necessarily negative. I don't want to say that, like, I mean, it was just what I grew up in, right? But like people weren't allowed to come over, right? Kids weren't allowed to come over. Those of you that know me know that I'm over 6 foot tall. I hit 6 foot at 13. Okay. That's middle school, y'all. So you can only imagine, you know, not only did I have the whole, you know, yes, I'm a girl. Yes, my name's Kyle and I'm 6 feet tall. And I'm 13 and my mom grows weed and I'm totally feeling out of there. I mean, like I didn't check any boxes. You know what I mean? I felt very disconnected from a very young age. And, but I would go to my dad's on the weekends, right? Because he was always there and always a great, great dad. You know, and he would take me every other weekend and I got to see glimmers of normalcy, you know, and I'm so thankful for that today because it was a baseline that I could kind of build from, like, oh, you don't have to have knockdown drag out fights. Oh, it's not normal to like know the freaking, you know, bartender's names at, you know, fill in the blank for every bar on Riverside and South First, you know? Because I would always call these places looking for my mom. Right. So anyway, that's how I grew up. Not good, not bad. It just is what it is. And, so I didn't think there was anything weird about, selling weed when I hit 16 or 17. I just kind of thought that was what you did, you know? And I learned that there was like, a currency, like I felt needed by people. And so I would always try to make sure that I had what people needed. I left my mom's house when I was 16. I don't like to say I got kicked out much anymore because it was really kind of an agreement. I moved in with my dad for the first time full time when I was 16 years old, because, you know, I was a straight A student. You know, I played French horn in the band at Crockett. I was really a nerd. I mean, totally. I know that's not hard to believe, but I was totally a nerd. And but my mom found out I was having sex with my boyfriend and she lost it, you know. She absolutely lost it. That was not okay. And so I left my mom's house because she was going to make things impossible for me to kind of still be rewarded really for my, you know, for excelling at stuff. Like I felt like, well, you can't treat me like that just because, well, she could. And so I chose not to let her. She's the mom, right? So, anyway, I went to live with my dad. That meant moving to Dallas. I got to Dallas. I was extremely promiscuous in Dallas. I actually went to the hospital when I was 16. They didn't know what it was. It ended up being advanced chlamydia. I was in the hospital in the children's ward. I like to tell this story because I was literally 16 in the kids' ward, like balloons and blocks and all that crap in my room. And I'm literally getting IV antibiotics for an STD, like for real. It was weird. It was at that time that I actually was also diagnosed as being HIV positive. 16 years old, right? 1991. And then at that point, that was a death sentence. So I had not been, I had not done drugs yet at this point, but like I said, I had been very promiscuous. And, you know, 2 months later, it turned out to be a false positive. Thank God. However, what I need you to know is during those 60 days, like while they sent my test or whatever off to California, like I literally thought I was going to die. So why not do drugs, right? Cause you're going to die. and that was kind of when I started dabbling with marijuana. And, anyway, my dad's like, we got to get out of here. Right. So he takes a job in San Diego. So here I am, you know, Austin's, and I get out to San Diego and I was off to the races. I get to San Diego and I was just off to the races. I don't know how else to put it. I only needed one class to graduate. I was out of school by 9:30 every morning. Anyway, I fell in with a crowd that was doing meth. That was kind of that. I ended up, you know, being away from my dad's home, you know, my dad who'd always been there for me, who'd always been very, very constant in my life. I had a 3-year-old little sister at the time and a stepmom, and I was just an absolute wreck for that family. I absolutely tore through that family. And so oddly, but truthfully, they moved to one of my jaunts that I was gone. They moved to Australia. So I was gone for an extended period of time. And when I went to go back home to like get money, right, and get food and like sleep, you know, like I did at the time. And there was a lockbox on the door, right? And they had moved without telling me. My dad says he told me, and I probably should believe him, but I don't remember being told. I certainly was not asked to join them. Let's put it that way. So there I am, you know, maybe 17, like right on the 16, 17 cusp. I had a horrible meth addiction. Anyway, it was just ridiculous. My mom came out to, hadn't seen my mom in months and months. She came out to Austin, got my ass from a gosh, wow, it's such a long time ago, but in Julian, we were cooking dope up in Julian, which is just north of San Diego, and she literally got on the plane and came out to California and like literally on the freaking front door of this place. It was crazy. And so I didn't realize what a big deal that was until we get to the airport and she buys my ticket, right, to go home. Like, she had no idea if she was going to find me. She didn't know. Everybody told her she was an idiot for coming to California to get me. And you know, that may be, but I know that I would have a very different story today had my mom not gone out of her comfort zone and flown against everyone else's, you know, advice. Her boss even tried to tell her he was going to fire her if she went. And my mom was like, fuck you, that's my kid, you know? And I'm so thankful for that today. I really am. I don't think I really understood what a big deal that was until I got older and had a 17-year-old of my own, you know? So fast forward, I get back to Austin, basically same thing, you know, you're looking for it, you're going to find it, right? Because I am resourceful. I am, you know, pretty manipulative when I want to be, and I'm going to get what I want to get when I want to get it. I managed to stay in the cycle for years and years of where I was barely passing. Like, you know, I work in the legal field. I have my entire adult life. it is not hard for me to get a job, but keeping a job is completely a whole nother story. But the thing is that attorneys are notoriously horrible to work for. Sorry if anyone on here is an attorney, kind of not really. But they're very difficult to work for. And because of that, I always could get a job. You know, I never had a problem getting a job. Like I said, staying there was a different thing. So I used methamphetamines to, as like an appetite suppressant for years. And I would, you know, my alcohol of choice was always malt liquor. And you know, when I would sit around drinking malt liquor for, you know, weeks or whatever months, and I would be working, but I'd put on weight. And so it just made sense to me. I would rationalize it. Well, I'll just go get an 8-ball of dope and I'll lose 20 pounds. Like, that's how that works. So, and I was able to balance that for years. You know, they call it weekend tweaking, you know, unfortunately, Friday to Sunday turned into Thursday to Monday, which eventually was like, fuck it. You know, why stop? And I definitely was let go from several jobs. I have to say that when I was doing my financial amends and I sent off for my transcripts from the IRS, I literally had forgotten law firms that I'd worked for. And it was a very, difficult experience, because the second I saw the firm name on my transcript, I was like, my heart just sunk, because I remembered being walked to my car by a named partner with all my shit in a box. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I literally didn't remember places that I had worked. So that's not good. You know what I mean? That's not good at all. And again, I had really ruined my reputation in Houston. Thank God for temp agencies who don't really check anything. But during this time, I had kids. You know, I have today I have a 19-year-old daughter. Her name's Jasmine, and I have an 11-year-old son. His name is Elias. And I had Jasmine in 2000, and I was not doing dope when I had my daughter, but I was drinking and smoking weed. I did, however, use meth whenever I was pregnant with my son. And I say that because I want to let, you know, moms know that it's okay. You know, it absolutely doesn't have to be, it doesn't mean that I am the worst person in the entire world, even though that's what I felt like. What it means is I have a disease, and I was in my active addiction while I happened to be pregnant. And again, I say a lot of things sometimes that I just kind of like throw it out there, and people are like, whoa, like it. And I do that just because I want to make sure that you guys know that, you know, I might look like I have my shit together today, but, I don't. I mean, it's better than it was 5 years ago. But you know, life is still difficult. It really is. So what happened, so that's kind of what it was like. What happened was, on February 12th, 2015, my house was raided. What in Houston, and I say house, that's really stretching it. It was a one bedroom apartment in Southwest Houston that I was sharing with three gay guys. And, cause you know, that makes sense. Hey, Joey. And, I didn't realize what was going on, because my mom had always taught me to have a job, right? Make sure you have a paycheck, make sure that, you know, you are legit. And nobody, you know, I was so nice to the freaking apartment people, dude. I really was. I would like bake them cookies. And one time I even had something accidentally put in my mailbox, and it wasn't addressed to me. And it was from Pandora, that like jewelry place, that online jewelry place or whatever. And I was like, oh, that's weird. So I walked it into the apartment complex. And I was like, I don't think I should have this. Like, this isn't my name, but it's got my apartment number on it. And they were like, oh, thank you. The reason I say that is because, again, that may be why I'm not in prison today. Because, when my house was raided, it was raided by the postal police, right? So I don't know if y'all are familiar that our post offices have police, but they do. And it's fed. It's for real. And I kind of laughed when I heard that because I was like, whatever, postal police, but it's true. It's a thing. And so the guys in my apartment were stealing mail, basically, and getting account numbers off of checks and then kiting the checks and then sending in crash test dummies to, you know, to check cashing places. I was not a part of that. I really wasn't. And so I could literally say, like, I don't know what you're talking about, you know? And so even though my name was on the lease, my name, you know, all the electricity was in my name, everything was in my name. When those cops found all that dope there, because there was quite a bit of heroin and quite a bit of meth that was found at the apartment, because I sold heroin to support my meth habit and everyone else's meth habit. But the thing was, I was at work, right? I was at work. And so when I came home, I remember sitting in front of my door and going, something is weird. And it was like, cause all the doors were black, but my door was that fresh wood, right? Like it was a brand new door, guys. And I was like, oh, that means that wasn't there this morning. And it's like all of a sudden, you know, all the red flag, red flag, red flag. And this lady, her name's Lupita, she came over and she was like, oh my gosh, the police want to talk to you. I've been trying to call all your phone numbers, blah, blah, blah. Cause none of it was real, you know, getting that apartment. Like I Adobe Pro'd all of that. And, anyway, she was like, they keep on saying that you're a drug dealer. And I keep telling them you can't be, you go to work every day. You bake us cookies. You bring things into the office that, you know, aren't yours that you get in the mail. Like there's just no way. Like, I don't know about all those guys you live with, but we told them there's no way. Well, that's all fine and good. But, I still had to definitely be questioned. They knew all about my situation. My kids had been with my mom at that point for 2 years. I hadn't seen them in almost a year. And my first husband was also in that world, and he, ended up being indicted a couple of months later, and they knew all about him. And they knew my kids were in Travis County. You know, it was all just a little too much. So basically, because drugs were not on the search warrant, they let me go. But they said that that would never happen again. Right. They were like, that will never happen again. We know now. And so because all this, you know, check equipment and, you know, all that other crap. So those guys went away. I lost a bunch of money and a bunch of dope, but whatever. I felt like I had a second chance. So I was able to hustle up enough money to get a storage unit. I ended up living in the pool house of this trust fund baby that I was sold GHB to for about a month. And then on March 12th, I checked myself into Harris County Psychiatric Center, and that's where my journey began. And I'm so, so, so thankful that I, you know, lied to them that day and told them things that were not true, but that I knew the second I said it, they would have to keep me. That was not oddly in my nature. Even as messed up as I was, I hated lying to them. And then it was interesting because David actually is the one that drops me off. And he was clean at the time. Cause he had just gotten out of the DDRP program, which is the dual diagnosis, rehabilitation program. Cause he got locked up because of all of our hijinks. And anyway, they tried to take away my cigarettes and I was like, you know, I don't know if I'm ready. Like I knew I had to quit using meth, but I was not ready to stop smoking. I was not. And, it literally almost kept me out of treatment. It literally almost kept me from getting help. It was that big of a monkey for me at the time. But yet I still was able to go in and, you know, they got me hooked up with Volunteers of America in Fifth Ward, Houston. I was able to, you know, go from HCPC. I got medicated. My son came to visit me while I was in, the psych ward. And that's really all I wanted was I wanted to be able to see him. And so my mom sent him to see me because she knew he'd be safe because I was in the psych ward, you know, and David actually brought Elias to see me, and he was so happy. And that's when I realized that that's really all kids want, right? They just want us to be okay. All Elias wanted was to know that I was okay and that I loved him. And that was kind of that jumpstart that I really needed to be serious about this stuff. So I got to Volunteers of America. I let them know I wanted to come to Austin. I ended up relapsing at one point because there was a delay in when my bed was ready. And when they found out there was a bed for me at AR, they were like, oh, fuck that, you're out of here. So I had 2 hours to get out. And I stayed clean for 5 days, but then Cinco de Mayo rolled around, and that's where I come up on my whole thing about if you're a drug addict, chances are you're an alcoholic too, because I knew that I was a meth addict, right? I knew I was a meth addict, but I still was hanging on to this thing that I could drink, that I could like have a glass of wine with dinner. Like that doesn't happen, right? Or that I could like go on a picnic or go on a wine tour or whatever. I knew that was the delusion. That was me lying to myself. So that way the alcoholic could get in there. Cause again, I'm a methaholic, and that's how that meth gets in there, is through alcohol. So it was Cinco de Mayo, and I was like, let's go have a margarita. And of course, my partner in crime was like, let's go. We go 2 margaritas later. God bless the dope man. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, if we're going to get it, we're going to get it. And I got it. And that's just how that happens. And anyway, I say that because I had a 7-day run. And my sober date's May 12th, 2015. I came to Austin Recovery. It was so different than Volunteers of America. They weren't shoving Jesus down my throat, which was really kind of important for me because I didn't know if I believed in that. I mean, I knew I prayed to him whenever I got pulled over by the cops, but I didn't really know if I wanted to worship him. So I knew there was something, but I didn't know what that thing was. And so that kind of brings me to this other, I like to also use a prayer that really helped me in my very beginning of getting clean. And it's actually in my black book, this book that, you know, we got from AR when I first got there, but it's a Celebrate Recovery prayer. And it really, really helps me because it's just different enough that it's so much, I don't know. It just really helped me. And it says, "Dear God, I want to take the first choice towards healing and spiritual health today. I realize that I'm not you, God. I've often tried to control my problems, my pain, my image, and even other people as if I were you, and I'm sorry. I've tried to deny my problems by staying busy," oh, that's a big one for me, "and keeping myself distracted, but I'm not running anymore. I admit that I am helpless to control this tendency to do things I know are unhealthy for me. Today, I am asking for your help. I humbly ask you to take all of the pieces of my unmanageable life and begin the process of healing me. Please heal me. Please give me the strength to choose health. Please help me to stick with this process for the next choices. In your name I pray. Amen." And that was a really, that for me was just different enough from 86, 87, and 88 that it became a large tool in my tool belt. Because like I said, I'm the real deal Holyfield. Like it's not, I can't just AA it. I'm like an NA, CMA, Celebrate Recovery, go to church. I mean, I am like, I'm trying to pull from all different aspects, you know, meditation, guided meditation, having a spiritual mentor, surrounding myself with women, who wants better, you know, and really what's so important for me today is the same thing that was important to me when I first got clean. And I know this because I told my husband this, and you know, it's really funny because we can tell our husbands things and then we realize that we can tell ourselves the same thing. But I told David when he first got clean, I'm like, if it doesn't have to do with your kids or staying clean, then you don't have time for it. Bam. And he has since said that that was really helpful for him. And so I have to tell you that today, you know, I'm able to walk with my kids through some pretty serious stuff. You know, my daughter has some pretty serious mental health issues that are being addressed. You know, she was diagnosed as being borderline and also being bipolar. And, you know, it is not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. It is a delicate dance. But as long as I can keep a pipe out of her mouth and, you know, a beverage out of her, an alcoholic beverage out of her mouth, then we're good. And she's, you know, she does DBT classes. I was able to teach her at a very, very, important age, 14 years old, 15 years old, what it looks like to follow something through until it gets better. Right. Because I had shown her how to fail. I had shown her how to run away. I had shown her, you know, what being a good mom wasn't. But what was so cool is that the second I started walking the walk, and the second I started asking her to go to meetings with me, and the second that I started being home 10 to 15 minutes after the meeting was over, and not an hour and a half after the meeting was over, or the next day, like, that was all she needed. Was literally about 6 months of solid not lying. That's it. Just not lying to her. I didn't realize how much of my parenting was done under the guise of lies. Like, oh, I've got to go to work, right? I've got to go to work. Oh, I'm late because of work. I'm in a bad mood because of my boss. I'm in a, like, you know, always trying to cover for my own act of addiction by blaming other people. And so when it came time for me to get a job, you know, Jasmine was flipping because she was just like, well, but now you're going to have all those things, you're going to start happening again. And they didn't, and they haven't. And I'm so thankful for that. And, this Austin recovery community is a huge reason why. I mean, Chris is not joking. I mean, it literally used to be, you know, me and Tommy and Rob Golston and John Mack, you know what I'm saying? And then we started, you know, and then Chris came around, and then we had the Tonys and the Tommys and the Joeys and the, oh my gosh. And all of a sudden, like, there were too many people for one room. And what I realized was that it had been really bare, you know? It didn't feel bare, though, while we were there, right? And that's what's so amazing to me, is that I had everything that I needed in that room, even when there were only five of us, you know? And I made it a point to go to every single Thursday and Sunday meeting for an entire year. There was not one meeting that I missed, because it was what I needed to stay clean. And so I just want to tell you guys that, you know, that's, I tend to get really nervous when I tell my story, but then I have to remind myself that this doesn't have anything to do with anything other than just, this is what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like today. And I have to say that it is so much better today than I ever thought possible. And that is only because I was able to, you know, just stop trying to be in control of everything and stop trying to act like I was somebody I wasn't. And then that brings me finally to my other, and I know you guys, those of you who've heard my story, but page 124 of the big book is absolutely what I rest on today. And that is that this painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to that, and cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. And that for me is the only reason why I'm able to continue putting one foot in front of the other and not constantly beat myself over the head about, you know, all the things that I did to my kids, and be, you know, and just running away from life, that all of that dark past is the greatest possession that I have today. And it's because I to share. I get to share this with fellow addicts. And I really appreciate you guys, you know, zooming in and listening to me this evening. I love each and every one of you. Even if I don't know you, I love you. And thank you so much for taking the time to listen to a little slice of my life. Thank you.
Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
Kyle, yay!
That was great, Kyle.